Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, depending on where you are in the world. Welcome to a new edition of Kayfabe Wrestling Radio. We are grateful to our sponsors, WeekendWarriorWrestlingBlog.com, for helping us be a part of Spreaker.com and iTunes. We have ourselves an international guest, and over the 6 years we've done this show, it's great when we get former world champions to be a part of this podcast. And this gentleman is former TNA world champion, multiple belt holder around the world. I didn't get to see him compete on it because I never really watched it, but he is a former gladiator overseas on the TV shows. He also has his own personal training business, his own book, which we'll talk about in a few moments, called The Superstar Body, superstarbodybook.com, cheap plug there. And this Saturday, along with his lovely companion, Mickey James, he'll be a part of the Ashlyn McClure Memorial event, which is being hosted by Total Wrestling Explosion. I'm going to read this off a poster the Mickey James at Instagram posted. It is 278 Highway 309 North in, as we were trying to figure out, we think it's pronounced Byhalia, Mississippi. You knew him on TNA Wrestling as Magnus. He is Nick Aldis joining us here on the program, and I'm very honored. This only took from February to now to put together, but it's still great to have you here with us.
Yeah, and it only took you 10 minutes for that incredibly detailed intro.
We were talking before.
We're running out of time, guys. We'll have to wrap this up. But this has been great. Thanks very much.
Yes, he's got a date with a young child who wants to go swimming. So sorry, kids. You've been a very.
Hold on. We're gonna have to qualify that. That's very easy. That sounds very odd. My son is the young child in question.
Yes, exactly.
His son is about to come out from behind the crowd. I'm glad we got to take that out. Otherwise, there'll be all kinds of misrepresented headlines all over the internet.
Before we talk about how you arrived at TNA, this has been a story that we're going to discuss on our podcast at another time. That's got legs is someone like Cody Rhodes leaving a lucrative position in WWE because of either, as he said, the creative direction wasn't there. He put on this checklist amazingly online, which, yes, Cody Rhodes, Battle of Los Angeles, holy cow, that's pretty cool. When you look at someone like that, do you sit there as someone who did it yourself, leaving a nice position in TNA wrestling, do you say, well done, sir? Or do you kind of sit there and go, that's interesting, I'm kind of glad I never went down that WWE road?
I think that it's too difficult to, the team in this business is really such a minefield, you know, by itself. It's really difficult to judge or pass judgment or even really pass opinion on how anybody else is sort of approaching their own career. I really think that it all depends on the individual, and I've always been a fan of his work, and obviously his pedigree is there, and I'm sure that for him in many ways the sign of being a wrestler in the wrestling business and, you know, making stuff probably wore off quite quickly because he's been around it his whole life. But that, again, I could be wrong. But, you know, I would imagine that for a guy like him, having seen obviously his successful dad and his brother, you know, he probably, not to say that he didn't work hard for it, but I'm sure that he probably just knew that if he applied himself and did, and you know, got good at it, and he's from what I understand, he was a hella athlete. Like, he was a great amateur wrestler and stuff. So, you know, he's one of those guys that he's just good at anything he tries. So I'm sure that to him, you know, he probably just was like, all right, let's get going and get into this. And you know, and he obviously made strides in WWE very quickly and deservedly so. And then I'm sure that to him, it's like. He's not one of those guys that's like every day going like, oh, wow, like, an arena, you know, like, oh, I'm on TV, like, it's so cool, you know. For him, it's business, you know, and he's probably just looking at it and going like, all right, you know, you weigh up the finances versus the sort of creative satisfaction versus the, you know, a bunch of different things. But, you know, if he's anything like I was, and obviously we're talking about two completely different animals here, because he was in WWE making great money and, you know, achieving a much higher level of sort of notoriety than I have. But he probably weighs it up the same way, like, it's JR that always says, like, it's about cash or create, you know, and in many ways it is. Like, I think that the creative part of it comes in early and then the cash part comes later. But that's just me, you know, and I think that for him, maybe he's just, you know, he's done well enough. He's probably thinking, if he's anything like me, he's probably thinking, I could stick around here and be, you know, unfulfilled and probably annoy a bunch of people in the process and run the risk of like burning a bridge here forever. Or I can go and, you know, go and sort of explore and see what comes of it and, you know, trust my instincts. You know, but again, if he's happy, then good for him. I don't think that anyone can sit here and go, I can't believe he would do that. Like, what, you know, it's because everybody's circumstances are totally different, and I can only speak from my experience where my number one reason for leaving TNA was money. Let me turn my phone notifications off. Terribly unprofessional.
You're fine.
I wasn't fulfilled, that's for sure. Like, pretty much, you know, after I did the stuff with, I lost the title and then kind of floundered around for a bit, did some stuff with Palmer, with Bram, sorry, and I was glad to facilitate him coming into the company, and I knew he would do well, and, like, seeing that now. But, you know, and then, like, I liked most of the angle with James as well, with Mickey, but, you know, aside from those things, it was, just familiarity from Breed Contempt, and I was probably getting, like, close to the 7-year itch, because it had been, like, 6 years there and stuff, but ultimately, I would have powered through those things if the contract that I had at that time would have been, you know, extended, but it wasn't, you know, and that's because they weren't in a position to be able to do it at that time. Had they been, I would have stayed, you know what I mean? Like, that's it, because I've got to provide a living from my son. But it certainly wasn't like I was going, you know, I'm going to go and, like, make a huge splash. You know? Honestly, I don't have the, I like being on TV, you know? I've always been a big proponent of that part of the business. Like, I like that side of the business, you know, as much, if not more, than the in-ring product. I still think, like, right now the business is in a bit of a weird period where the emphasis on wrestling and, like, you know, wrestling matches and, like, epic matches, you know, is too strong, and it's, like, and it's reflecting in the viewing figures. You know, business is down. Like, anyone can say what they want, but business is down, and that's because regular, casual, everyday kind of in-and-out viewers are, like, they feel like they're not invited to this club. You know what I mean? And that's kind of where things are at. Like, if you're a diehard, like, all about wrestling and about the match and everything else, then, like, you're satisfied. But if you're the kind of guy that used to dip in and out and go, like, oh, yeah, cool, like, I like that guy's catchphrases, and, like, oh, this guy's cool, like, no, this guy's a dick, like, I know someone beat him up, yeah, they did. That guy isn't as easily satisfied now, I don't think. You know, so.
Is it safe to say the highest point or the greatest moment of your run in TNA is the World Championship run, or was there something else that you would say, well, that the championship's 1A, but this is 1B? Because, I mean, from anyone we've ever talked to on this, yes, we understand it's a work, it's the championship's the greatest accolade you could receive, but is there something else that may rival that as like 1B?
I think defeating Sting one on one clean with a submission in the middle mm-hmm. of the ring on a pay per view is that immediately puts me in a bracket of like two. I think Bret Hart is the only other person who has ever done that. I don't think I could be wrong, but I believe that I think Bret Hart is the only other person that has a submission victory over Sting. And that, although, you know, there was, you know, there obviously neither of us were totally satisfied with that match, for a couple of different reasons, but when it comes down to it, to me, like, that moment, like, that whole sort of chapter was to me, was, I think, was the high point, in the sense that, you know, that something like that doesn't happen without Sting basically, you know, deciding not, you know, that wasn't something that was suggested to him, like, that was something that Sting wanted to do. You know, like, that
wow.
whole thing was, you know, because you're a guy like him, like, you don't, you know, you pretty much call your own shot. And, you know, so, and I wouldn't, I won't disrespect TNA by explaining, you know, what was mm-hmm. were leading up to that, but
oh, that's fine.
But the fact that, you know, the fact that I was able to get a submission victory over Sting in the middle of the ring was—that was down to one person. That was Sting.
Mm-hmm.
So I think to me, on a professional level, that's an incredibly high point, because that meant a hell of a lot to me.
Mm.
And it was, you know, and it was a culmination, I think, that where, you know, again, not to say that they didn't do this with me, but. TNA, there have been times, and TNA aren't the only people to do it. WWE have done it, WCW did it, you know, every company has done it somewhere or another, and often there are way more circumstances than people really know. But there have been times where they had built a guy, someone had been on their way, and like ready to, and the fans were ready to accept them in the next level, you know, as a player, like in a meaningful, you know, meaningful role, that, like, and someone who they believe in, you know, in the top spot. And then they don't quite follow through. There has mm-hmm. been, you know, there have been many cases of that. And I think Sting has seen, perhaps, in my case, a couple of occasions where, you know, where perhaps that opportunity had been there and hadn't quite, like, they decided the timing wasn't quite right, or it needed a more, you know, a little more, or whatever. And I think that it came down to, I think me, like, that moment and the match I had with AJ in St. Louis for the finals of the Bound for Glory series were like
mm-hmm.
that was the match that got me to a different level. That was the audience. Sorry, I'm jumping all over the page here, but
you're fine.
So like obviously that's a perfect example of how you can be made by losing a match. You know,
mm-hmm.
and I, you know, AJ and I had this great match. I had beaten Bobby Roode earlier in the night, which is, you know, which is a huge honor for anyone in the business to see a guy like him. AJ had won against Aries, you know, and I remember coming up to that thinking, like, oh, this is supposed to be like double babyface, like, these guys are going to just chew me up and spit me out. AJ, you know what I mean? There's no way these guys, the audience is going to accept me as a 50-50 thing. And then it ended up really conservatively being like 60-40. You know, in AJ's favor, which to me I thought was which I was like, I'll take that. I'm happy with that. And you know, we gave him a great match. And you know, and the, you know, the ending to that was the best piece of business that we ever did, as far as myself and TNA, in the sense that AJ gets the win, and then I sit on the apron and I'm like looking out, like I've got, like, you know, I kind of water up my eyes a little bit, and you know, they get this great shot of me just kind of looking up, like I can't believe it, you know what I mean? And Taz did a great job on commentary, and my, you know, Taz, I remember Taz going, like, he's got nothing to be ashamed of, you know, he busted his ass, like, you know, blah blah blah, like, what a great showing. And it was like, that's what made me, you know what I mean? Like, that's what
mm-hmm.
that moment right there was where I came back and Sting said, you need to be the world champion by the end of the year.
You know, oh wow.
And then So when it came to then, like, because we knew that's where we were going with the story, was to meet the then reference things, and I was going to be like, I can't believe it, you know what I mean? I worked all year for this, and then I couldn't come through in the end. And things says, you know, okay, fine, you want a match where you can prove yourself, what about a match with me, you know? So we get to the... to California, and that was, you know, that was October, and then Sting basically, let's just put it this way, there was another plan for how that was going to go, and Sting basically said, no, like, this, you know, which is very rare for him, he doesn't do that, you know, he's a great, like, he's all business, but he said today, this business needs to be, you know, this is the way this needs to go, and you know it, and this is what we're doing. And
wow. That's impressive.
I had, you know, like, I can't, like, I couldn't say anything, you know, and I'm sure that in many ways, I think, was a little bit of a beginning of a kind of souring of a relationship between me and John, because, you know, we're all men, we've all got egos, you know, and I think that even though it wasn't me, you know, I had nothing to do with it, like, it wasn't like I sat there and went, you got to tell him, like, I should win, you know? I think the fact that he, you know, that was one of those situations where it was like he, you know, Sting basically just put me in the place that this is what we're doing. You know, I think that put a little bit of a sour taste in his mouth for me after that, which, you know, which was no fault of mine, but I always felt like that was a bit of a turning point. But that moment, like that, you know, from like professional, like I remember, like we were sitting there and we had Kurt to help us, you know, like with some of the match and everything like that, and I just said to Steve, you know, you, like, this is your call, you know what I mean, like, we can do it however you want, like, I'll be there. And he just sort of sat there for a couple of minutes and then sort of looked at me and looked at Kurt and said, I think I want to tap out for the Cloverleaf, you know what I mean?
Holy cow.
All right, you know, like, I kind of said, well, I really appreciate that, you know. And Kurt was kind of like, I forget, like, this thing kind of got up. He said, oh, you know, we'll talk again later. Like, kind of walked away. But Kurt looked at me and he goes, you never wanted to do that for me. But, like, I remember that whole day, you know, just, that was a, like, you know, the match, we weren't entirely happy with how the match went. Like, I think the audience were a little bit confused by this weird sort of angle thing we had to do at the end. And, but from a professional standpoint and personal, you know, that moment to me was always like this is something I'll let you know that, like, very few people will ever get to do, and he decided in that moment that he'd always been a big supporter of mine, and I'll never forget that.
In the few minutes we have remaining here with Nick Aldis, it is at Magnus Official on Twitter. If you want to check that out, it'll also be listed in our recap of this time with him. I don't want to have you do like a long version of this answer because you probably haven't asked it tons and tons of times. What leads you to sit there one day and go, I'm a pretty buff dude. I want to write a book. And I want to share it with all these other people in the world.
I don't know if I've ever sat there and said to myself, I'm a pretty buff dude.
Okay. I thought maybe you look at yourself in the mirror and just go, I'm jacked.
Flip side version, obviously, I have been, you know, I've for as long as I've been a follower and a fan of pro wrestling, I was sort of also, you know, it naturally led me to be a fan of like bodybuilding and fitness culture and everything like that. You know, the guys who initially kind of turned me onto the product were as a small kid, was, you know, probably like Warrior and like Undertaker and, you know, Bret the Hitman Hart was like always he's still my favorite wrestler to this day, you know.
Oh, wow.
But he was sort of my hero as a child, you know, but then as a teenager, like, as I started to become rebellious and like wanted to make my mark and do my own thing. Wrestling was, you know, that was right where the Attitude Era was starting to explode. By the time we got to like 2000, you know, Triple H, which to me was just like he was like a god. You know, he had this incredible body and like but like just such a cool presence about him, and like the, you know, the, his whole presentation, and like with him and The Rock feuding, that like you know, I could have watched 10 hours of him and The Rock, you know, going back and forth. Like it would, you know, like that sort of that feud was the one that made me go like, I want to be in this, like I want to be like these guys. And and I, you know, I didn't have a very positive body image by that point, you know, which is the modern term for it. You know, I was skinny and like I wasn't, you know, I was like I was skipped a grade in high school, right? So I was like always around. So, and it was partly because of my academics, but also because of my athletics. So like all the coaches wanted me on the year above. So basically, they got my parents together and said like, smart enough and good enough at sports, like we can skip him a grade, right? So I was always around people older than me. So every, you know, so like I was always a year younger than everyone and all my friends. So like they all got their driver's license before me. They all did this and this before me and stuff like that. And I think that had elements of it too. But I basically just started lifting weights when I was about 12 or 13. And then by the time I was 14, 15, like it was really, you know, you could see progress. And I just, it was just part of my life. And I think that I learned a lot of stuff through trial and error, which I think is always an important thing for people who are going to maintain a good physique. And then I became a sponge, and I just realized like it taught me a lot of learning, because I realized, you know, I wasn't ever going to be able to recite to you, you know, Pythagoras theorem, you know, no matter how many times I read it, like I'm going to forget it like in an hour from now. But I can read a whole chapter on, you know, on protein synthesis, nitrogen retention, you know, this and that, all these different types of things, and recite it forever. I know it. So I realized that I, you know, I had a passion for this, and so as long as I've been wrestling and pursuing that career, you know, obviously I've just always maintained a, you know, an interest in a following of bodybuilding and stuff and fitness. And then it just came about because I wrote a column for FSM. I have done for many years, and so I would get, you know, it always went. Fans, you know, there was the fans who will sort of say like, oh, I read your column, I really like it, blah, blah, blah. So I knew my writing was starting to get better. I've always had a passion for doing that too. And then around like, probably around 2012-ish, like I was, you know, I was starting to really get towards like, my best shape, like in my mid-20s, like 25, 26, like, I was really starting to get like, my best shape when I was like, tagging with Joe and then going on to do all that other stuff. So I would get a lot of emails and tweets and stuff like that asking advice, you know, like, what's, like, man, I want to look like you. Or even, I even remember, I remember when Hogan and that came in, like, I remember Hogan's son, Nick, you know, coming and hanging out with us a few times, and Nick Hogan going, like, I want to come and train with you, like, he was kind of making noise about maybe wanting to get into the business, but, like, he's like, if I ever get into the business, I want to look like that, Dad, you know what I mean? That was so weird to hear, like, hear Nick Hogan telling his dad, like, I want to look like that guy, you know what I mean? And I remember just thinking, like, oh, like, so weird, you know what I mean? Like, Hulk Hogan wants to look like me. I think just a number of those things made me just think, maybe I could, you know, and I had it in the back of my mind, and then a friend of mine, the journalist, wrote a book about British pro wrestling. He asked me if they could use a picture of me on the cover, which I took as a huge, you know, which was a huge compliment, and I said absolutely.
Oh, wow.
The only thing I asked is that maybe can you, you know, maybe make a connection with me and the publisher, you know, and maybe we can talk about if there's any chance for me to do anything with them down the line, and that's pretty much how it went. And then I started working on it. Took me about a year to do all in all to get different things, and I finally got it done.
Wow. If we, there's so much to ask with so little time. If you could give a 30-second thing on, like, the biggest thing you see when you start with a new client that you see with a lot of folks when they go to the gym, what's like Nick Aldis's biggest annoyance or pet peeve of workout people?
Okay. Well, look, let me qualify this by saying, like, I'm not like I'm working like full time as a personal trainer. Like, I basically have a concierge personal training service that I'll take on. Like, basically, like, I'll take on a client if I have the time. If they contact me and they have the right, you know, it's the right person and the right timing and it's what they're looking to do. Like, it's not like I'm, you know, I really sort of, I'm really doing it more as like a sort of side, you know, concierge. But so they have to me, like, they have to want it. Like, they have to really, you know, want it. Because you have to sort of, you can tell within a couple of sessions whether they have the desire to actually change or whether they just think because they have it. I'd say that the biggest thing that I see with most people, and I'm guilty of it in my own way, but it's inconsistency. Like, you can tell people, like, listen, you know, you can do this, but if you get lazy, you know, if you get lazy with your diet, and you constantly do this, like, this is one, for example, like, I try and rewire Mickey's thinking moment. Like, listen, you're a snacker, right? Like, you know, you think because you eat clean for, like, four meals a day, that you can grab a candy bar or grab a chip or whatever, and that's not going to make a big difference.
Right,
but it's actually better to have one day where you go totally nuts. You have, it's actually much better to have one day where you have, and that's where the whole 2 day came from. It's actually much better to do like one day where you go totally berserk and eat all kinds of crap in one day, you know, and just go like, I don't care today, like, and because your body won't. After a while, if you get yourself well conditioned, your body won't be able to assimilate all that. So most of it will just pass through. But if you feed it a little bit of crap every day, like, it sort of becomes used to it, the same way that if you feed it good stuff, it becomes used to it. There's little things like that, you know, it's hard to, like, there are a lot of habits that are hard to break, you know, and I think the thing with the book I tried to do is to try and make it where it was doable for people in the real world. That's why I called it real world technique, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be one in a million people are going to be the kind of person that is happy to, like, pre-prepare rice, chicken, asparagus, and, like, box it up and put it in the fridge and eat nothing but that. Like, that's, you know, I live like that from time to time if I've got, you know, if I need to kick it back in. But most of the time, like, if you're educated enough on, like, good ingredients and how to make tasty food without using the wrong stuff, it's pretty easy to, well, like, you know, and eat like a real person. But I think most people, you know, They think of the stuff that it takes to get a body like they see on TV. They think it requires like this huge, like almost monk like, you know, level of discipline, which it doesn't. It does require a little bit, you know, it does require knowledge, you know, and so that's why I try to share it with people, and you know, it's pretty easy to read. Like, the feedback's been really good, so I've been pleased with it.
As we mentioned earlier, he is a part of an event in Byhalia, Mississippi. You can follow him. He has two Twitter accounts. It is @MagnusOfficial. It is Superstar_Body. So if you want to interact with Mr. Aldous and possibly even check out the book itself, it is superstarbodybook.com. We are very gracious that he was here with us. We're going to let him go swim, but stay with me after we stop recording. We thank him for being here. We will be back. We do have another interview scheduled for this evening, which we will not tease now because it's not 100% locked in place. So thank you for joining us here on KFA Wrestling Radio, and we'll see you at the matches.